I'm one of your hosts, Eddie Webb, and with me are Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello.
And last time we talked, I remember Dixie saying she would look at the screen and not wanting to say Eddie Fate. And I never had that problem myself until just now. I looked at it, almost like Dixie Cyanide.
It's rubbing off on you. It's my curse. So
this is already starting off to be an amazing show. But today, what we're doing is we're trying something a little bit different. Some people have really enjoyed our deep dive episodes, and we're going to keep doing those, no question. But one of the things we thought about is, like, what do our listeners want us to talk about? And we got a lot of responses. The idea was basically I put out to Twitter. I just said, hey, what kind of games can we sell you on? What kind of games have you been looking at for Onyx Path that either you don't know a lot about or even kind of gone, maybe it's not for me, and give us a chance to kind of just tell you a little bit about the game. So we're doing our a bumper crop of mini deep dives, shallow dives.
Don't, which you shouldn't do. That's bad advice.
You should never do that.
Paddling.
It's a terrible idea.
We are paddling in, yes, in the pool of games.
Our aquatic metaphor is already falling apart.
The dice pool?
If you like, yes. Yes, the warm, ammonia, stinky, shallow end.
Why would you make it gross? I don't want to be in this pool anymore with you two. I was picturing like a sparkling, beautiful pool, a sunny day. It's like 20 degrees here right now. So I was like in that picture. And then you were like, it's disgusting. It's full of disgusting things.
Well, I'm given to understand that chlorine is odorless. And so when people go to a swimming pool and they think, oh, the chlorine stinks here.
I'm going to hate this fact, aren't I?
It's not the chlorine at all. It's the reaction of chlorine and ammonia that makes that odor. And ammonia comes off people's bodies and, of course, is produced by people's bodies in various lovely ways, especially children in swimming pools. So that smell you can smell is the people. It's their sweat. It's their bodily fluids. Enjoy your swim.
I'm never going to a pool again.
And that's what we're doing today. We're swimming in the rancid, festering waters of Onyx Path Publishing's games.
What? You're the worst at marketing.
At this point in time, I should clarify, this is why we are not in the marketing team.
Yeah, I am never going to ask Matthew to sell me anything ever again.
What we've decided what we're going to do is that we have 10 different games that we've narrowed down from the lots that people have asked us about.
10 games in one.
And we're going to cycle through them. But because all of us are prone to being chatty, I think it's fair to say.
No, I never talk. Mm-mm. Very quiet. Like,
yeah, whatever.
Super introverted.
Right. So we're going to limit ourselves to 5 minutes apiece. So this is kind of like a 10 lightning round sales pitch. So it's a bit like actually what we would have if you met us at a convention. You know, it's like, hey, what's this game about? Usually it is just kind of some of the pattern we might use, or like, you know, just as we talk about the games that we know about. It may not be polished. Some of us will be like, it's kind of like this, kind of like that, because, you know, not all the games we know as well. And we'll be talking about them and interjecting as we usually do. But we're going to try to time box these to 5 minutes apiece. Matthew has been voluntold that he is the timekeeper.
Yes.
I'm ostensibly the host. We're going to be hosts kind of in a different time period.
I'm not doing shit.
It's going to be crazy. Dixie is going to just... Well, Dixie has the... drawing the short straw, actually has four different games she has to talk about. So
I'm just super punchy already because we were making this like a terrible morning show or game show right before we started recording. So I'm like in that like weird punchy mindset of like, I'm just going to yell about stuff.
With a blur! It's the 5 minute rundown! It's the paddling in the shallow end! It's the deep dive into the Onyx Power Publishing game catalog! Wow!
Eddie, Matthew, and Dixie in the morning.
I'm fully clipping it out now. That's going to be a new sound clip.
Oh, no. I'm crying. All right. I'm literally so crying.
Let's get started then. Now's the best time to start on this.
Okay.
So first on the list is Exalted.
Did you really do that to me?
And with Exalted as the first on the list for you happy listeners out there trapped on the motorway this warm and wet Wednesday morning, I'm going to start the timer on a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right, so the really cool thing about Exalted to me is its scope. is a huge game, and I don't mean that just in the size of the book, although that is a joke we can all make. Yes, the core book is a bit large. That's partially why now when we do Kickstarters, we separate into two different books. Like, there's a core book that's already written, and then a companion book for extra information. But so Creation is just, it's huge. There's so many cities of 500,000 people. It's not your typical kind of fantasy setting where you're going to, like, yes, you can go to a village, but you're not going to spend a lot of your time in, like, villages and rural areas unless you really want to. You can do just about anything with this game. But it's all on a big, epic, heroic scale, which is what I think is so much fun about it. Like, Creation is huge. You are the, you know, chosen of gods. So that's already kind of huge. And not in, like, a Scion, like, part mortal kind of way. Like, in a, the shortest lived exalts, I think, live for, like, 300 years, and the longest lived ones live for, like, 5,000 years.
Like, oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
That's sidereals for you. They can live, like, I think, 2,000 to 5,000 years.
Sidereals are the best, by the way.
They're my favorite. So there's a bunch of different types of exalts. There's solar exalted, who get their power from the unconquered sun. There's lunar exalted, chosen of Luna. They can shapeshift and do all kinds of nifty stuff. We either still have or are just wrapping up a Kickstarter with them, which is super awesome. There's the dragon-blooded. They're the more terrestrial ones. They have different aspects like earth, air, fire, etc. They are also the most numerous. There's a lot more of them in Creation than anybody else. But if you want something where you can do like those big, epic, like, anime-type fights, or even things like, you know, the big Lord of the Rings battles where you've got somebody just sweeping their arm and hundreds of people go flying across the battlefield. That's what Exalted is for. It also, unlike some of the other big, like, epic combat-y games, rewards very good storytelling. There's a system in Exalted that I love that's called Stunts, where the kind of more big and epic and overwrought your description is of what you're doing, whether it is praying to your god or punching someone in the face, the more successes you get, and also you may get bonus dice. So it really does lend a it lends itself to role-playing more than I think a lot of fantasy games do. A lot of people say like role role playing, not role roll playing. And Exalted is amazing for that. Like, can you do stuff without describing it in a big way? Sure. But much like Cavaliers, which I'm going to talk about a little later, I do believe, it is a game where your descriptions and your emotions and what you're investing into the game rewards you in-game as well. It's also, you can get experiences from very good role-playing. I said experiences. Sorry, Chronicles of Darkness brain. but you can get XP from that. Like I said, the World of Creation is so big, it's so varied. Every single city, every single zone is something that we've done as a mix of like some traditional fantasy elements and some real world cultures that we've kind of cribbed from, mostly ancient and historic ones. So like, you suddenly need your people to trek across a desert for 40 days, go over there. You suddenly need your people to go to a city of 1,000,000 people so they can find someone who's missing, go that way. You know, like it's you can do just about anything with it with one game. A lot of people that play Exalted campaigns end up playing them for like years, from what I understand, just because there's so much you can possibly do.
I know one of the things that I love about Exalted is the fact that the charm systems are all based off skills, and there's a very strong attempt to try to make even a less obvious charms compelling. So like, there's really cool and interesting like debate charms and, you know, legal charms.
Right. So when I say you can do anything with it, that's another part of it. Your character can be just about anything. If you want to be dude with big sword that hits guys with his sword, great, you can do that. That's fine. But if you want to be incredibly charming blacksmith whose forge is literally magic, you can do that too. Like, we have systems for that, which is really, really cool to me. So you can play just about anything. You can do just about anything. Like, if you can think of it, you could probably figure out a way to do it via charms or systems. Now, something that a lot of people say they're daunted about with Exalted is the size of the charms chapter. I get it. There's a lot of them. Couple things you can do. One, Exalted's a great game for a session zero, where you just hang out and make characters and figure out how they know each other. I actually enjoy doing that personally, so that's not a problem to me. And two, it can be a thing where the storyteller, if they really want to, can go in and give them kind of a slimmed down or restricted charms list, which I've heard of some folks doing, where they're like, okay, there's a little bit too much going on here. To start with, just look at these, you know, 30 pages of them instead of the whole chapter, and just pick from these. And it really just depends on if you want your players to poke around in the book and play around and kind of figure out exactly what they want.
I'm afraid your time has come to an end.
I did it though. I talked.
Congratulations. You have talked about Exalted for 5 minutes.
Without deviation, repetition, or any of the rest of it. No, well done. Excellent.
Actually, it does sound really cool. I mean, yeah, I've been kind of aware of Exalted. I've done some dev work on Exalted, but the way you described it, actually, it does sound really appealing. It's like you've described it in a way that I've never really heard of before. It's like, that's so cool. You could do so much with it.
It's a big epic fantasy game. I think people get hung up on the mechanics, and it's like, nah, it's a role-playing game. It is for role-playing.
Absolutely.
All right, what's next?
All right. I'm up next.
Introduce yourself.
My name is Eddie Webb. I'm going to be asking myself questions during the course of this. someone asked for Legend Lord. So I gave you a hard one. I'm giving myself a hard one too for a game that's not even out yet. I have to now sell.
Very nice. And it's still being written. In red lines yet? Like, where is
it? No, it's not in red lines yet. It's still in first draft. So this is going to be amazing.
We sell you on our first draft of a game.
Right.
I'm very interested to hear this one. Okay, Eddie, your time is about to start. Get yourself ready, warm up your lips. And on a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So Legend Lore is actually a licensed product that we're working on. It is based off of the Legend Lore comic, also known as The Realm, that is currently being published by Caliber Comics. It's a fascinating world because it is, on the surface, a very traditional kind of high fantasy world, D&D world. And in fact, the book that we're making is going to be compatible for the 5th edition of Dungeons & Dragons. It's a source book for Dungeons & Dragons. But the conceit of the game is that a group of teenagers from our world are actually drawn into this fantasy world. And they have to kind of come to terms with it, and they don't really escape. You know, there's the D&D cartoon style of, you know, how do we get back home? But eventually they set down roots in this world and they have lives. So one of the fascinating things about Legend Lore, at least at the pitch that we've talked about, is the fact that you can play yourself or someone that you know, or a person from the modern world, and how they deal with this fantastical environment. And so we've had some interesting discussions. Steffi Devan is the developer for that. And so we had some initial kind of conversations during the outline stage about how does this work on a mechanical level. And one of the things is that the comic does present is the idea of you kind of become your idealized self when you go into this world. So the original first couple of comics, like the jock becomes bigger and stronger and eventually becomes kind of a fighter barbarian type. The intelligent girl, she starts to learn magic haphazardly, and that actually causes some tension with other parts of the party because she eventually finds faith and becomes a cleric. So we want to kind of emphasize that aspect of the experience. And so there's this idea that you can draw on not only yourself, the modern day version of your character, but also the legend that you're evolving into. That the world is slowly pushing you in a certain direction. You kind of work against that or with that, but that gives you certain kind of mechanical teeth to it.
So can I ask what's the tone of the game? Is it more like, because when I hear this story, I think like gritty, like The Magicians, or like sweet, like Narnia, or like kind of funny, like the book Off to Be the Wizard.
It's probably between gritty and sweet. I mean, there's certainly some kind of Narnia-esque elements. One of the things that I think is great about this world is that it does use kind of the tropes of fantasy and then examines them a bit. So it's like elves are going to work a lot like you expect elves to do. Dwarves are going to act a lot like you expect dwarves to do. But then what happens if you're coming from a world that understands these tropes to a certain level?
Do you have to play humans, or like can your character become an elf when they go to the other world?
You can change that. That's something we're still kind of nailing down. Last time I talked to Steffi about that, we kind of want to make sure that it's hit correctly, because another thing is Steffi's very, very passionate about inclusivity. So we're trying to make sure that when we talk about these topics, we're doing them in a respectful way. So like we should not talk, for example, about making sure disability erasure doesn't happen.
Right.
But also, the other thing that's great about this way is that we also want to present it so that way, if you want to just play your part of this world and skip the whole you've switched over, you can. You can just take this as a normal D&D style world. And it has its own interesting bits and pieces inside of it. And there are the conflicts, there's a war building, and so on and so forth. So if you want to just, hey, I want an off the rack D&D world, you can totally play it like that. And you don't have to use any of the people coming over. But also, there are bits like, at one point a plane crashed in the mountains, and so you're trying to send armies over there to acquire the artifacts that might be hidden in the mountains as a result of that crash. So there's a bit of almost a little bit like a Pugmire-ish vibe to it too, where it's not post-apocalyptic, but there are bits and pieces of modern technology that kind of crop up, or bits and pieces of modern culture that show up, and they get kind of synthesized into this fantasy world. So if you want to play just a straight fantasy world with weird bits of modern day culture or modern day tech, you can.
So it's urban fantasy fantasy.
It is, it is. And that's what I think is so fascinating about the game, is that it's as much or as little as you want to put into it. There's a lot of different tacks. It seems like a very simple concept, but there's actually a lot of different tacks you could take and how you want to approach the material.
It's quite fascinating to me, because for a very long time, this is what fantasy fiction was. It was always about humans from our world experiencing something weird rather than a completely separate world's mythos.
Exactly right. By being able to take, we are going to have to queue to existing.
Well, we won't be taking anything, Eddie. Yeah. I just ate up about 10 seconds of your last 5 minutes.
Which I appreciate. But I mean, it's going to be cool. I think it's going to be a really interesting book when it finally gets done.
I will say that the issue with this format is going to be that Eddie and I talk extremely fast, so we're going to have to work to fill the space a lot more than Matthew, who actually thinks about what he's saying.
It is true. I will be dragging out my lovely, lovely vowels, and might cover one's concept from a game before I get to the end.
All right, so I'm going to give you your hard one up front, Matthew. You ready? You can work. You're going to sell us on Promethean.
Very well.
Start
now?
Your own clock.
Oh, I'm going to count myself down. Okay. I see how it is. That's nice.
You're the timer. Remember, I don't do shit. Eddie's the host. You're the timer. We established this at the beginning.
I will time keep myself for Promethean the Created in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So. I'm going to take that. Promethean the Created is a Chronicles of Darkness game in which you play your Frankenstein's monster-style creatures. You're animated, you're reanimated, your constructs, your beings that never were, but desperately seek the spark of life. Some of them already possess it, in a manner of speaking. None of them are human, as we would know it, but many of them pine for humanity and undertake great pilgrimages to discover it. Those pilgrimages require experiencing the highs and lows of everything human experience has to offer. They may have to embark on a war, they may have to track down a murderer, they may have to experience love, they may need the excitement of successfully committing a heist, or the perhaps justice of bringing down a terrible tyrant. And often Prometheans will band together in parties known as throngs so that they can assist each other on their pilgrimage. But the tragedy is that it's very rare for all pilgrimages to come to an end at the same time. And one Promethean may reach that level of humanity before the rest of his companions, and it therefore becomes known that there will always be one left who may not be able to reach that culmination point because all of their companions have abandoned them by then. The journey of Promethean the Created is incredibly humanist in ideal. There's this idea that no matter the sins and virtues of humanity, it is better to be human and be able to experience all of the joys and sorrows of being human than it is to have it forever denied to you. The various Prometheans you can play in this game, they range from the Frankensteins that were composed of various body parts. You could be a Tammuz, which is, if memory serves, a being made of clay or rock. There are Galatides that are often seen as beautiful dolls given life for sometimes for pleasure, sometimes for experience, sometimes made out of some humanistic ideal of what a human should look like, but mm-hmm. always having that uncanny valley appearance. There are unfleshed, which could be anything from a shopping android that greets people in the mall and it discovers life for itself, through to extempore, which are a kind of I'm going to have to think of the word here, a conglomeration of spirits or spirit stuff that finds, again, this humanoid mindset, this humanoid drive. Now, quite often there needs to be some kind of creator, some kind of individual who first grants that Promethean the spark of life. Sometimes that is another Promethean. Sometimes yeah. it is a human who has possessed that gift, and it often comes back to destroy them. Unfortunately, when Prometheans go to create life of their own, and often they have to do this to advance on their pilgrimage, it isn't ever going to be a case that all Prometheans will just be gone because they'll all become human. They have to divest a little of themselves to create further created. Sometimes it creates a Promethean just like them. Sometimes, however, it creates a horrible aberration known as a Kashmalim, and other such creatures that aren't quite right. Sometimes I think in first edition they were best seen as towers of hands, limbs, faces, things that again just Ooh. Should not be.
Yeah,
they're pretty terrifying.
Yeah. And I always enjoy that kind of body horror. But Promethean the Creator 2nd Edition, and I specifically call out 2nd Edition, is, to use a term from the game, the ultimate refinement of Promethean. It perfectly balances the systems, the kind of powers you can use as a Promethean that are world-altering, and indeed as a Promethean you can poison the world around you if you're not careful, or set it ablaze because you, again, should not technically exist. But 2nd Edition has a fantastic balance between the setting of the game, the system of the game. It gives excellent reasoning for why Prometheans might band together, and it's a game I strongly recommend to anyone who's a big fan of the internal horror of Chronicles of Darkness, which it's so well known for. And I'm done.
Oh wow, that was good timing.
He did that on purpose. That wasn't 5 minutes.
That's 5 minutes just now.
He was just like, I'm done. We can't trust him. He holds all the power over the time. Well, he's going to make me talk for 15 minutes next.
Well, whoever comes to edit this episode could just cut a minute out of the middle of that, so all the listeners agree with you. But that's down to Eddie. Is Eddie honest? Which one of us does he like more?
I'm just flinging accusations.
Right. You were all my children. I love you equally.
That's weird.
Yeah, right. I don't know why I went there. Never mind. But I'll edit that part out. How are there?
Hey, you were like not 9 when we were born. Like, that's
spiritually. Maybe he's our creator, and we are but Prometheans, Dixie.
Right. Anyhow, enough of that. Next one, Dixie, you're back up.
Yeah.
And we are going.
What are we talking about?
Cavaliers of Mars.
On the early morning road show with Dixie, Eddie, and Matthew.
In
5, 4. Yes, I'm getting to it. In 15, 14, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Okay, what I tell people at every convention when they ask me, because somebody always asks me, is that Cavaliers of Mars is John Carter meets Three Musketeers.
Right.
It is a game of swashbuckling, of romance, of adventure, of all those things that you want in that kind of, you know, I don't know, big swashbuckly setting. I feel like there should be a better word than swashbuckling, but there's not. There's just not.
Yeah.
That's the best freaking word.
It is the best word.
You're playing a cavalier. You've got a big hat and a flint laser and maybe a sword, and you're just, it's amazing. So Cavaliers of Mars is a game by Rose Bailey. It was kind of her pet project for many, many, many years, and I am super lucky to be actually holding the book in my hand right now.
Yeah.
The way that she always tells the story, which I think she had on our episode with her, is that it started with kind of a, you know, if Mars has water, it must have canals. If Mars has canals, it must have a Venice. And flourished from there. The other way that I like to describe the setting of Cavaliers of Mars is that it's pre-apocalyptic. It is a dying Earth. At some point, somebody came and made Mars livable. Those people aren't around anymore. So there are remnants of technology that keep the planet kind of going, that keep the canals working, that keep the atmosphere working, but no one knows how to fix it. No one knows how they work.
And if I may ask, how futuristic is this technology to our contemporary minds?
I would say to our contemporary minds, it might not look super futuristic. It might be like more of a near future thing than like a super far future thing. Mm. But to their kind of 18th, 19th century level of technology, it looks ridiculous. Yeah. Like it makes no sense. Nothing makes sense. A lot of the canals run under the planet's surface. They have switchbacks. People who travel them are sometimes end up in places they never wanted to go. Because who knows where everything leads sometimes. There's a ton of different people in the book as far as various peoples you can play. There are the Wyeth women, who are made of essentially plants. They live in Wyeth Valley. It's this beautiful green lush place, and then it leads into some terrifying places later. There are various kinds of Martians. There's the red Martians, who are the closest to what we think of as humans, although they are, you know, still different. There's pale Martians, there's roundheads, there's all the ones I always forget, like the Skroot and the Zayus. So there's all kinds of different cool, interesting sorts of people you can play that aren't your typical, you know, just humans or fantasy humans, elves, dwarves. They've all got very unique characteristics. And one of the things I like most about Cavaliers of Mars is the system. It is very, very big on, kind of like Exalted, actually, on narrating what you're doing, on using the environment around you. You are encouraged to swing from a chandelier and things like that, much like in all those, you know, wonderful adventure movies and books from back in the day.
Where you have to cry, ha-ha, when you land.
Absolutely. Yeah, very important.
Exactly. Hmm. Also, your dice change. The dice you are using for things change depending on your motivation. So if your character is very motivated by love, then they might get a d10 assigned to for love. So if they do anything with that motivation, they get a better die to roll. Mm-hmm. Now, if they have for love as their main motivation, but they're doing something for honor, which is their, you know, d6, then that's going to lessen their roll. So it really does encourage you to think about your character's motivations for doing things, and not just what you think is the best thing to do.
That's one of the things I love about the system, is the fact that every action you take, you have to think about why you're doing it.
Right, exactly. Now, the core book for Cavaliers of Mars is absolutely beautiful. It's only $35, which is actually not a whole lot for one of our big hardback books, which is awesome. The art is black and white, but I think it's very it's black and white with purpose. It's very, like, black and white to illustrate the kind of story it is. Mm-hmm. All the art is gorgeous, and we also have about 4 million story hooks and pre-made characters in here. So you can play this with just the Quick Start Festival of Blades, which I do believe is still on DriveThru RPG.
Yep.
You can definitely play a whole game with just that. Or if you wanted to get the actual book, you could probably play hundreds of games with the material that we've put in this book. We also got a couple of new things coming out for really, really soon. So
yeah, and I know one of the things that I've always liked about Cavaliers of Mars is they actually have a kind of a dueling system where you have to actually allocate your dice to different actions and stuff.
Yeah, and you can also play the entire game without rolling dice if you want to. We have a sidebar called Do You Want to Have a Sword Fight, which we sing to the tune of Do You Want to Build a Snowman from Frozen. Megan and I at Gen Con 2 years ago got a little punch drunk and wrote the whole thing, and then promptly forgot it. But the point is, you cannot roll dice. You can play this as a purely narrative game if you want. I know a lot of people, myself included, like the chance aspect that rolling dice gives, but you don't have to.
No one cares. Not anymore.
Wow! You just insulted me and Rose Bailey.
The Wilhelm scream overrules all of us. At that point, anything we say doesn't matter.
Scream rules everything around me.
Exactly.
It kind of defines our entire lives.
Incoherent screaming!
Yes, won't somebody stop the screaming?
The screaming room. Well, one day we'll just have an hour-long episode, just us screaming for an hour.
Oh, yeah, some nice primal scream therapy for the pathcasters.
And then we can encourage people to scream along with us in their cars.
Yes, that won't cause any problems whatsoever. Okay.
I mean, I feel like my car is the safest place to scream.
Well, it's fair, but people also see you and you might crash. But anyway,
that's what we should do for when we become big morning radio DJs, like we've always planned. For, we should say, "Okay, ladies and gentlemen, driving your cars out on a sunny morning, we want all of you to scream at your loudest in 3, 2, 1, and then you'd hear all the way down the freeway thousands of people just screaming behind their wheels and rocking backwards and forwards, only for 5 seconds, and then they have to get back to their normal life.
Instead of the 10 minutes hate from, or the 2 minutes hate from 1984, it's the 5 second scream.
Yes. Or that, what's that movie where you have the network where that guy is saying, I'm not going to take it anymore. I want you to open your windows and stick your head out and say, I've had enough of this, and so on. It's an obscure movie, I will grant you, but it's a good scene.
Matthew, you have 5 minutes. Tell us on the network.
No, stop. No. Left off control. Focus. Back on track. We got 6 more minutes to get through.
I'm doing shit.
Yeah, Eddie. You're up next, I believe.
Compose yourself.
And yes, compose yourself. Massage right. That tongue. You are... That's what weird. Are you talking about?
In a completely fair and not at all biased way, I have selected Pugmire for the game I'm going to talk about.
People did request it, just so
people
you know.
Did request
it's not,
it, yes.
It's not just Eddie selecting it himself.
But also, yes. I was like, talk about Pugmire. Oh, yes, please, can I?
I mean, I did volunteer too, so you wouldn't have to be so self-serving, but here we are.
That's cool.
Okay. Okay, Eddie, your vocal cords are warmed up, so in 5... Me, Mamo. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So, a lot of times when people ask me about Pugmire, I get two big questions. First one is kind of, what is it? And the answer to that is that it is a game. It's a fantasy game set far in the future where humanity has been left behind and dogs and cats and other animals have been uplifted. So it's kind of Lord of the Rings meets Planet of the Apes, but with dogs. You've probably heard me say that phrase before. You'll probably hear it a lot more in the years to come. But the other question I often get is, are you for real? And the answer is yes. It's on the surface, it's definitely a lighthearted game, and it's very totally different from a lot of the other games that Onyx Path makes, and that's absolutely true. But there is a depth to the game that a lot of people find once they start to read it or play it, because I definitely try to draw from serious animal stories, not only older, using animals as allegories like Aesop's Fables and the like, but also more modern things like Mouse and Mouse Guard and Redwall. There is this long vein of animal stories as kind of a way to tell human stories. So Pugmire really is a lot of that. These are people that happen to look like Staffordshire Terriers and cats and, geckos and the like. And that's definitely intentional. But it is meant to be evocative of also the nostalgia we have as a community for games like Dungeons & Dragons.
Well, I've got a question for you, Eddie, to interrupt your flow. A question that often comes up to do with Pugmire, which I know can be incredibly irritating, is it a funny game?
That's fair. And I think the answer is it's as funny as you want it to be. It's actually something I've had to sometimes talk with writers about, is because there's a natural inclination to put a lot of puns into the game. Mm-hmm. It is a game that gravitates very quickly to that style of humor. And one thing I advise writers is, like, I want to leave that space for players to make those puns. Like, I have heard the, oh my, I'm so dog tired, and throw me a bone. I've heard that gag like literally a zillion times. But every time the player's saying it, they think they're the first person to say it, and they think it's funny at the moment. And they should feel like that's cool and funny at the moment, because that's their game. So I have certainly run the game to be a little on the silly side. I've seen lots of people run the silly side. My default way of running the game personally is I tend to go a little more morbid, because when I was pitching it to Rich, one of the things that he came back with, this image I love, is that with humanity gone and the dogs left behind, it's much like culturally the dog that sits at the door waiting for their owner to come back.
Which is so sad.
It is. It's heartbreaking. And I think that I've always felt that there's a melancholic undertone to the whole setting. But, at the end of the day, this is a setting where you could play a schnauzer with a giant battle axe. I mean, that's just funny. And you go into dungeons to pick up old iPads. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
The idea that, because magic is technology. Our technology is farther in our future from now, but the world it sees it as ancient. So they just, it's just magic to them. So all the magic you see, it's definitely coached in a traditional fantasy metaphor, but it's meant to be technological. So there's a lot of depth there. But I mean, you know, to your question, Matthew, certainly there's people who are like, you know, is it a funny game? It can be. And I don't shy away from that. Certainly we, it's not as funny as, like, say, They Came From Beneath the Sea, but it's also has room for that in a way that World of Darkness doesn't have, or even Exalted doesn't have quite the same level of potential for humor that Pugmire does. So there's a lot of that capability there. Another question you ask, can you play a cat? And that is Monarchy's Amount, which is a separate game and therefore ineligible for this rant. But
can I play a bird? Can I play a lizard?
If you want to play a bird or a lizard, that is going to be upcoming Pirates of Pugmire book, which is also ineligible for this rant.
No, I do
for asking that question.
I do love that setting element. To go back to the melancholic, the idea that not just the dogs waiting on the doorstep for owner to come back, but the idea of when the humans don't come back, the next cultural step is to start building and acting in the same way as mankind or humankind right. used to. It's it makes sense.
Right. And so they have what they call the Code of Man, which is basically their faith. And so, you know, things that man or humanity or the old ones told them that they need to do. So it's like, be a good dog, fetch what's been left behind.
You're done.
There are
kid.
Only two tenets of the Code right. of Man.
There are 15 commandments. Crash. 10 commandments.
10 commandments.
Well, okay. Well done.
I do love Pugmire, though. Yeah. I am glad we got to talk about that one a little bit, because that's one that I talk about a lot. And it's one of the very few role-playing games that I felt super comfortable running, because I feel like it does have such a, like, specific tone.
Mm-hmm.
And I've run one game of Pugmire and one game of Monarchies of Mal. And my Pugmire game was that hilarious, ridiculous, pun, silly, everything. My right. Monarchies of Mal game was actually very serious and intrigue-laden, which... it's kind of the tone of that, but I honestly didn't expect it to go that way. I thought it would be a little bit more like light, but it got very, very dark. And I was like, okay, cool. Let's just murder some people, I guess.
No, definitely. I have joked that the default tone of Mao is kind of vampire light.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing of the intrigue there.
They do have necromancers after all. Mancers, exactly. I should say.
Right. Okay. Next topic. Matthew, you're up.
Well, yeah. What am I talking about?
The tweet in question only asked for werewolf, but...
Well, I'll just talk about werewolves in general.
Right, yeah, just say...
Talk about One Night Ultimate Werewolf.
Right, or talk about a teen wolf. There you go.
Okay, done.
American Werewolf in London.
I'm going to use my executive powers as host, and I'm going to declare arbitrarily and not at all rehearsed that you're going to be talking about Werewolf the Forsaken.
Oh, really? Okay. In that case, I will start in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. No! Oh! Friends! Romans! Uratha. So, Werewolf the Forsaken. The thing is, what...
Just gibbering random things at this point.
While I have... No, that's the thing. That's the thing here, Eddie. That's a very good question, or very good statement. Because in Werewolf the Forsaken, the werewolves, the Uratha, have a first tongue. They have their own language. And that's a nice way to start this little one-sided discussion on the subject of werewolf. Because there's something I like in role-playing games when they have their own cant, as it's called in Planescape and Old English. Where they have their own language, lingua franca, if you like. And werewolves in Werewolf the Forsaken have such a history, such a culture, so much mythological lore, and it's so important to the game that they even have their own language, a spirit language, which is called the First Tongue, that only they and other spirits can understand. And it's peppered throughout Werewolf the Forsaken, and I don't find it to be overbearing, thankfully. But it really adds a layer of flavor to this game that I truly appreciate. It's the kind of thing that a storyteller or players can take or leave, but I think to make it have real impact when you're running a game Werewolf of the Forsaken, if you have werewolves in their natural habitat talking to each other in normal English, but when they interact, or whatever the language of your gaming group, but whenever they interact with spirits, those spirits start in inserting parts of the first tongue, it starts making them feel more alien. And right. I know I've already spent a minute talking about that. Let's talk about Werewolf as the game itself is set up. It's a game about three core aspects, I would say. And that is the pack, so the sort of family unit, the party unit in which you operate, where everyone has a role and every member is as important as each other. You stand together, you fall together. Territory. And territory doesn't just have to be in the rural wilds. It can be a block in a city. It can be literally an apartment block, an entire skyscraper, if you like, where you might need to defend that territory against encroaching spirits or encroaching other werewolves, sometimes the pure, who are your much maligned cousins for good reason. But it's also about the hunt. And the hunt is part of the game that I am particularly in love with. I love a game that has a vast array of colourful antagonists. It's the reason I love Batman as a superhero. It's why I love The Flash and Spider-Man as superheroes, because they're very much defined by the diversity of their villains or rogues in The Flash's case. And Werewolf of Forsaken is a game that benefits hugely from this. You, of course, have your malevolent spirits that are malevolent in a very alien way. They're malevolent as far as you're concerned. They just do what comes naturally to them. With the Aslu, your spider spirits, your shards of spider that basically infest human hosts and get them to harden the gauntlet, weave webs between the our world and the shadow so that other spirits can't pass through, making a world increasingly cold and mundane. And then you have the Beshalu, the rat spirits that will again infest human hosts to wonderful body horror magnitude, where a stomach might burst open and a torrent of rats will spill out. As rats do, gross. They like to... Yes, it is a gross game, but they like to burrow holes through the gauntlet and make it easier for spirits to pass through. You have a whole load of these kinds of creatures. You, of course, have the pure that I've mentioned. Those are werewolf tribes that are incredibly territorial due to some ancestral cultural grudge against the Forsaken, the kinds of werewolves you're playing. They are constantly at odds with you. And those are the werewolves that are most likely to engage in things like cannibalism, in the hunting of humans, and the general bestial behavior werewolves are often known for. And there are more pure than there are Forsaken in this setting. You are very much on the back foot there. While Forsaken often operate in cities, the pure have pretty much all of the wilds. You have the Idagam, of course, the almost primary antagonist of second edition, which are massive cosmic horrors that can choose to manifest or not. But if you're familiar with Lovecraftian mythos, the Idagam kind of fulfill that role. They are creatures or entities far from werewolf past. And they, of course, again, have completely alien motivations that aren't generally in the best interests of humankind or werewolves. And that's me done.
This is a great format. We definitely have to do it again at some point.
Yeah, I'm actually having a really good time. I feel like we should talk about like just random things or, you know, books. Be like, I don't care. I'm enjoying this.
It's like we're sat in a bar. It's like we're sat in a bar and we're just telling each other about the games we love.
All right, a bar that arbitrarily cuts you off.
Yeah, I was going to say a bar that occasionally the Wilhelm screenplays.
That bar, to be fair.
That's the very frustrated bartender saying, last orders, please. And we keep just hanging around.
And see, I just feel like it's kind of like speed dating. Where we're like, all right, let's go.
Speed dating with games.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Actually, I think they do that, actually, at conventions at like Gen Con or PAX Unplugged. I saw that as an event. It was like
that's kind of what demos are, really.
Yeah, but they had them like all in a room, and you just like did the whole switch thing like you do when you're speed dating, I guess. Okay. I don't know. I have never speed dated nor speed gamed like that, but I think that was the actual setup. But it was like gaming speed dating.
Darren Brown did that once, where he played something like 12 games of chess all at once, and he just kept jumping from table to table and somehow still managed to beat 9 of the people who were playing, despite having no chess experience whatsoever. I don't know whether any of them fell in love with him, whether they ended up going back to have a long-lasting relationship, or whether that was the point. But I do remember the trick. Anyway, it's back to Dixie now.
Back to Dixie. You ready, Dixie?
I don't know what I'm talking about.
You are talking about Geist of Sin Eaters, second edition if you can, but you know, we're going to stick to it. You don't have to.
I don't know anything about first edition, so sure.
There you go. Second edition it is.
Okay, then, in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Geist of Sin Eaters, it's a Chronicles of Darkness game, 2E, obviously. One of the things that I've mentioned before, like on our Wraith deep dive, is that Wraith never really had a Chronicles game. This is about the closest spiritual successor you can get to Wraith in Chronicles of Darkness. I know that the one thing I will say about 1E is I know it got released when it wasn't quite finished. It got a little rushed as a project, so it was kind of a weird game that came out of the very tail end of some of the White Wolf CCP stuff. So this was our chance to kind of really like rework it, love on it, make it better. The developer Travis Stout was fantastic, but what I love about Geist is that it's all about like death is not the end. You have died. Like that's how it starts. You're dead. You can even start it when you're alive and then you play through your death scene. But after you die, you make a deal that brings you back. You make a deal with a Geist. You are referred to as a Sin Eater or as bound. There are lots of various things that we'll call you, but essentially you died with something plaguing your soul. Either you didn't accomplish something, you never found something, or you want to seek vengeance, whatever. One thing that I know we changed for second edition is that the thing that brings you back, your burden, it's not about how you died, which is what it used to be. Like all the splats in Geist you see based on how you died. Like deaths by chance were one splat.
Yep.
Deaths by, you know, being murdered were one splat, whatever. Now it's why you come back, which I think gives you a whole lot better motivation.
Interesting.
So it doesn't matter how you died, but if you're coming back for vengeance, then you're part of that kind of Geist. If you're coming back for love, you're part of that kind of Geist. I'm not going to remember all the names of the manuscript in front of me. That's one of the books that isn't out yet, so I can't reference it easily. I'm sorry.
Right. That's all I understand. But that's a really cool change. I like that, actually.
Yeah. It was actually, funny aside, I don't think everybody, not everybody realized we were making that change. So when I brought it to art direction, I kind of went like, we need new splat symbols for this book because the old ones don't work now. And they were like, oh, yeah, we do. So it'll be a set of... At some point, there will be all new splat symbols for Geist, which is exciting.
Yay.
But yeah, so you can work more in the underworld. You know, you can deal with the necromancers and people who live down there. Do you want to try to bring your Geist, the one who's bound to you, try to bring them peace? Because they don't have as much of a personality at this point because they've been a Geist for a long time. But you're kind of a like medium. You're kind of like half in the world of living, half in the world of the dead. There's all kinds of things you can accomplish. You can play around in underworlds, like I said. You can play around a little bit in the real world, solving crimes. There's a lot of in and out from... Whereas Wraith is played mostly in an underworld, and you have to like go through a whole lot to get back to the Skinlands. In Geist, you're doing a little bit of both. You tend to be more like you're running around, you're helping lay ghosts to rest, you're doing all those sorts of things. But also, you might have to go into the underworld to rescue people. One thing I love about 2E is that we do have all of your basic, you know, character creation, laws, antagonists, whatever. But we also did a really cool chapter called Quiet Places, which is a bunch of different story hooks and setting information for playing Geist from 16th century, I think, South America to modern day Scotland to Alabama in the early 20th century. And there's a ton of information on Dominions, which are some of the like underworld places, and some really, really, you know, scary things you can throw in there. There's a lot of interesting rules in this one as far as having like various manifestation and influence things for ghosts. There are, you know, haunts and merits, and it's a moderately involved system. I'd say it's a little less complex than, say, Promethean, but it's definitely a little more complex than your basic like Chronicles of Darkness rule. I think it's super, super fun, though. And we also have rules for your crew, which is the group of Geists. That's K-R-E-W-E.
Right.
There are different crew archetypes that you have in addition to your Geist archetypes that will also inform your character. It's like your X-Splat, your Y-Splat, you know, kind of how we always put it on different axes to make characters very, very interesting.
And one of the things I like about the crew system is that it's one of the Chronicles of Darkness games that doesn't come with pre-existing social groups, so you actually are making mm-hmm. them up as you play the game.
Right. Yeah. It's not like Vampire, where there's like an overarching kind of social group. You are making that up, essentially. Like mm-hmm. you are making up your pact or your, you know, what have you. I'm going to forget every word that I need to be able to say to explain this game.
It's all right. We're talking about a lot of games. I've already forgotten my name.
Matthew just that,
that said, there are a lot of super cool, like I said, keys which are some of your powers that you can use to unlock various things. The underworlds are really cool, but also the things you can do in the overworld are really cool. So if you want to just play okay, they'll never know if you want to just do whatever you
can. Just whatever. fine.
I will say too, one of our stretch goals is we're working on a fiction anthology right now. And I find that fiction anthologies are actually really good ways to kind of learn about the setting of a game, both fiction and novels. I haven't mentioned that before, but like the Exalted novels that we're just now putting out for third edition, I think are fantastic and super fun and full of story hooks. And then some of the fiction anthologies for various games are good ways to kind of get ideas for your personal game without having to write all the fiction yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, well, some of the fiction we've put out in the last few years has been excellent. And I do hope more people check it out. I think it's all available on drivethroughfiction.com. Some of it's even available now to buy via Amazon. Yeah. So if you're
someone's reading one of our novels, I heard.
One person is reading one of our novels.
What are we talking
Which
about?
Which person and what novel? How dare they? I need answers.
I don't know what you're talking about, Eddie.
Matthew's doing the narration for Vigilance.
Thing.
Wow. I was trying to be subtle and like I just missed the entire cast.
I thought you just meant somebody was reading one of our books, and I'm like, I hope so.
That's
like...
all right. We won't edit this out. If nothing else, this goes to show how fluid and organic this podcast is.
Yes.
Matthew is reading the Scarlands novel Vigilant aloud on his YouTube channel, Anonymous Path YouTube channel.
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
If you want things to be clear and obvious, I suppose you'd say it that way.
But also, we're not talking about Scarlands, so move on.
So we're now talking to Mr. Eddie Webb about Trinity Continuum Aeon. Or is it Aeon or is it Aeon?
We're talking about the whole continuum.
The whole damn continuum. Okay,
we had lots of people on both sides of this asking, and one person asked about Aberrant, so we're talking about it all at once.
And we're getting very close to the end of Driver's Hour here on on Dixie Eddie Matthew FM. So with that said, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So the Trinity Continuum is a collection of games, of which Aeon is one of them.
Is it a continuum?
It is a continuum of games. It actually goes from early on, time-wise, up toward Aeon. It's kind of the current end of that cycle. So we're kind of, we have the core book, which is modern day, and then Aeon is a current, like, kind of outside edge, and we're working backwards from there. But the Trinity Continuum is primarily a science fiction action adventure universe. So there's not magic in it, even though there are things that are happening that could be construed as such. But rather, it is like in the modern version, you're playing characters like super spies and explorers with, you know, two-fisted explorers, that kind of thing. So shows like 24, Leverage, those kinds of shows are the kinds of things we're shooting for. We're talking about this game. Aeon is our space opera version of the game. And Aberrant is which is in the process of getting rid of Kickstarter now, but that's our near future superheroic game. So from a timeline perspective, the core game has what are called talents. And talents are people who are able to consciously or unconsciously manipulate probability at a certain level, and also have just slightly higher than average capabilities. So when you're looking at a bomb and you figure out which wire to cut, and the action hero always inevitably gets the right wire to stop the countdown, it's because on an unconscious level, they're actually looking at all the possibilities, seeing which wire to cut, find the right one, and then collapsing those probabilities onto the one that's correct. And then you have access to a ability called narrative direction where they can actually rewrite reality at certain levels. So it's like you actually your gun ran out of ammo last scene, and so you can actually narratively rewrite to where you have a fresh clip in your pocket that you didn't mention till now, and you can use that and reload or what have you. And that's all happening kind of semi-diegetically inside the game, which is fascinating. Because one of the things I love about the Trinity conceit is that every chronicle is ostensibly true. The stuff that we present won't always necessarily... there's a long connection there, but they won't always exactly line up because there might be a slightly different version of the continuum. And so the game you're running is going to be different from the games we're writing, and both of those are equally valid because they're all different parallel universes.
Everything is canon.
Yeah, exactly. And I like the fact that the game kind of explicitly recognizes this on some level. The fact that, we are all playing in the same continuum, even though you're intentionally not using it, because we all know people very rarely run the books exactly as written. Usually they make their own little tweaks and adjustments and changes to the game. And Trinity explicitly says, yeah, that's great. So the idea is that we have these core setting books that attach to the core. So Trinity Continuum is the core rulebook, and then you have Aeon, which then uses the Trinity Continuum, because you can play talents in the far future, but you can also have what are called Scions, P-S-I-O-N, to avoid confusion for one of the upcoming comments. But Scions are they use psionics, but have become increasingly more powerful as a result. And so they use their abilities as part of space exploration, but also there's tons of intrigue between corporations. There's planetary colonies. There's a lot of, if you love movies like the Aliens franchise or certain elements of even Star Trek in there, there are certainly groups like the Aeon group that actually tries to go for more utopic view towards space, and there are others who actually have more kind of nefarious purposes.
I love that with that one you can play on Earth or in space very, very far away, and like both are equally valid.
Yeah, absolutely. Even though it's space opera, you're right, you can have an entirely very satisfying game just on Earth. In fact, the core book kind of emphasizes that a little bit. We have support books like Distant Worlds that's coming out soon. That's going to be much more, okay, I definitely want to go into space and do space stuff. I want to go on a 5-year mission. Then that's going to be the book that does that. Here's more alien races, how you even play aliens. So if you want to kind of have that more that a classic space opera approach, you can with those books. But also if you want to do like just a far future body swapping action adventure, corporate intrigue, that's also very valuable in Aeon. And Aberrant, I'll talk a little bit about because we're still developing it, but basically that is kind of 10 years in the future. So it's not cyberpunk. It's more just kind of near future. So it's going to be somewhat recognizable. What is that? What was that?
That's the Inception horn. I thought it was more appropriate for Trinity. So there you go.
I had to put, but what happened? Did Matthew explode?
It just sounded like traffic or something. I was like, what's happening?
Well, it's the morning hours. Hopefully the traffic's easing up now on the highway from destination A to destination B. Hang on, it wouldn't be a destination A, it would be origin point A. Oh, damn it. This is why I got fired from the last radio station.
Like, exit A to exit B. That would have made sense.
Yeah, yeah. Sadly, I just don't know the difference.
Well, luckily, you have to talk for 5 more minutes now, so...
Well, that can't go badly, can it?
No. You're doing so well so far. To kind of wrap up our Chronicles of Darkness tour, we're going to have you talk about Demon Descent.
Demon Descent, okay. I will talk about it in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So... Demon the Descent. Demon the Descent is the closest game, I would say, in Chronicles of Darkness to being an expansion to the core Chronicles of Darkness book, otherwise known as the God Machine Chronicle. Because in Chronicles of Darkness, being New World of Darkness 2nd Edition for anyone ill-educated, the primary antagonist, mover or shaker, supporting thing, entity in Chronicles of Darkness is this thing called the God Machine. In New World of Darkness, it was lots and lots of spirits. In Chronicles of Darkness, it's this god machine. And what the god machine is basically presented from lots of different abstract points of view in Chronicles of Darkness 2E to make it seem megalithic or alternatively something deeply insidious. And Demon of Descent follows on from that. Basically, the god machine is this... again, entity. It might be universal, it might be global, it might be buried underneath your feet, it might be in the room next door, and it has some kind of motivation that humans cannot possibly fathom. Mm-hmm. But in order to achieve its purpose, whatever its purpose might be, it could just be sustaining itself, it could be trying to advance to some kind of objective, it produces creatures known as angels, because the god machine is, after all, in some creatures' eyes, a god. Mm-hmm. And its angels... further its purposes. And those angels come in different shades, known as destroyers, guardians, messengers, psychopomps. Those are the incarnations of angels. They all, as the names imply, have various different purposes on our Earth. Now, most of those angels will adopt covers, they will masquerade as humans, and they will go about their business and go completely unnoticed. But sometimes there's a flaw in the programming. Sometimes an angel will do something that is not programmed to do. Sometimes it will witness something that it was not supposed to see. Sometimes it will just simply question its purpose, its agenda. And at that point, an angel falls, and that is where a demon comes from, the descent, where angels become demons, and demons are, for all intents and purposes, free angels. They retain the incarnation for which they were built, but they now have new agendas, being inquisitors, integrators, saboteurs, tempters. And most of them are fighting against the god machine and its agents in the form of these angels, in the form of cryptids, in the form of cultists that worship the god machine. Demons will do whatever they can to prevent the god machine from furthering its agenda. But at the same time, there are other demons that want to reintegrate with the god machine, find out what it was that they did wrong. They liked this delightful ignorance. It's very much a Matrix analog in that respect, where you can see an integrator as the Cypher character. But there's a wonderful spy movie, spy thriller, spy novel idea behind Demon the Descent as well, that wherever you are behind enemy lines, you're in enemy territory, and you are wearing a cover. And covers are one of my favorite things about Demon the Descent. Mm-hmm. That all of your characters, they're not just wearing human faces, they're not just pretending to be normal human beings going about their lives. The god machine influences parts of the world known as infrastructure, and infrastructure can come in many forms. It can literally be the shape of buildings around you, but it can also be the way people enter and exit a building. It can be how many people can stand in this elevator at any one time. It can be that this particular person is designated to achieve this function. And when you first become a demon, you are equipped with a cover. The cover you probably had when you were an angel, which is infrastructure basically wrapping around you to make the world see you as completely normal. Yes. And that cover can be broken. Some angels will be deliberately seeking you out, trying to break through your cover and return you to the god machine so you can be reprogrammed and repurposed. Now, there's so much more to the setting than this, but it makes it sound entirely like it is a clandestine game, but sometimes you can just break out and be the horrible demonic creature that you know you can be, with wings, with blazing eyes, and with godlike powers. And you basically unlock parts of yourself, parts of your destiny, as the game goes on, that you work on with the other members of your group, the other members of the ring. It is such a well thought out game that, unfortunately, I can't go into anymore because I've run out of time.
I will say on Demon, I didn't want to interrupt you because you were so like on a roll for that one. One thing I really like about Descent versus Fallen is that Descent implies purpose. Like, it implies agency.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I've always really liked that, where like Demon the Descent, like, maybe you regret your choice, but on some level, like, you chose this.
Yeah, I didn't even really get into the fact that this game is very much apart from the Abrahamic myth of Demon the Fallen. That right. There is very little of the idea of God and Lucifer and anything like that. It's technostic is how it's described in the game. Mm-hmm. And I think it is such a unique setting that everyone should take a look at it.
I completely agree.
Yeah. And also, once again, first book I ever did for Onyx Path was Demon Translation Guide. So yep. Demon the Descent was actually one of the first lines I ever worked on, technically.
There we go.
Which I think is cool. I don't know.
Well, we're getting ready to hit the home stretch here. We're at the last one, so I mean, Dixie, you're up one last time.
Mm-hmm. Which game is this? Sorry,
Dixie's going to be working on Scion.
Scion, I barely know it.
Are you going to go try to find an appropriate Scion sound now?
Yeah, you talk for 5 minutes. I'll find something to cue you up. So 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Right, Scion, S-C-I-O-N, as opposed to the Trinity Continuum Scion we're just talking about.
Right.
I have talked about Scion on this podcast so much, but I still feel like, you know, we can pitch this. So if you looked what I was talking about in Exalted, as in your children of gods, on some level, you have these big epic stories that are super awesome, but you also like what Eddie was just talking about with Trinity Continuum, where you start out as maybe just, you know, you've got a talent, you can kind of change things around you, and then things get bigger and bigger and bigger. Scion is the game for you, especially if you're also a fan of mythology.
Yeah.
And I don't just mean Greek and Roman mythology, I mean literally any mythology. I know Scion First Edition had rules even for, like, American mythological figures, like Paul Bunyan and King Arthur and things mm-hmm. like that. So in Scion, it's a set of two core books that we start with. One is called Origin, where you are playing essentially a, you know, human kind of level character, but who is still the child of a god, just hasn't come into their godlike powers yet.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have all those little, like, knacks and talents and things where you can kind of, you know, you're better than an average human, but you're not throwing magic around quite yet.
Right.
Once you get to hero level, you're throwing some magic around. It's pretty cool. At that point, you've been visited by your divine parent on some level, whether you've seen them in person or whether they sent a messenger. There's been some form of visitation, or your divine parent has chosen you, because not all Scions are born, some are chosen. And at that point, you start doing kind of god-like things, fighting monsters, people start to notice you. This is an urban fantasy setting. And it's an urban fantasy setting in which all myths are true, and everyone kind of knows that.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone in the setting, even just your average, you know, Joe on the street, does know that gods are real. They know that gods occasionally walk among us. If they see a Scion doing something obviously magical or godlike, they're more likely to whip out their iPhone and start recording than they are to, you know, run screaming.
Right.
It is very much kind of what would happen in modern day if, for the last several thousand years, we all knew that all myths are true. Much in the Trinity Continuum way, too, where, like, everything is canon.
Yeah.
Like, all myths are canon, even if they kind of contradict each other. Like, did the, you know, Japanese god of the ocean create the oceans, or did the Greek one? Well, they both did, on right. some level.
Obviously.
Yeah, of course. That's just how things work. So in Scion, you pick your divine parent, you start playing your Scion. You can start at origin level, you can start at hero level, and in the future, you can start at demigod or god level if you really want to. I think the most satisfying campaign would be a super long campaign where you start as, you know, ordinary, quote, air quotes, humans,
mm-hmm.
and then kind of find out throughout the game what the scope of your powers are, and by the end of it, you're in Terra Incognita and Underworlds battling monsters of myth and legend and titans.
Yeah.
Because that just seems like a really satisfying game to me, kind of in that legend lore way even, where you start off as, like, a human, and then next thing you know, you're like, oh, I'm a wizard. What? How did this right. happen? It's really cool how Scion pulls some of the parts I like from all of those games and combines them all. Now, granted, I am an urban fantasy fan, I am a mythology fan, so it's not hard to understand why I like this game. But I think it's really cool, too, because when you get your band together and you start getting goals for your band, you can have Scions from a bunch of different pantheons in one band. So you can have a Scion of Loki hanging out with a Scion of the Morrigan, hanging out with a Scion of Benten, you know, like there's so many different things you can do with it.
And if I remember correctly, you know, that band ultimately, yeah. as they become gods, could eventually become a new pantheon all themselves.
I do believe so. I mean, obviously I have not read God, would it be done yet? as far as first Scion, second edition. But yes, I believe that eventually you can kind of work your way up to the point where your origin story is almost inconsequential because you are now gods. And you are now doing your god thing with your god friends. And you might be, you know, picking Scions of your own.
God friends.
Wouldn't it be cool to play a game all the way from origin to god and then turn around and make your own Scions?
Yeah.
And start over again at origin level as Scions of your characters.
You are the Scion of me.
That's cool, though. Like, isn't
that
fun?
That would be fantastic, I think.
Yeah,
I can imagine it now. It would only take a few years, but it would be an excellent campaign, I imagine.
You could just start at god level. Just skip it. Either way, yeah. So if you like urban fantasy, but you also like mythology, and you also like stories that kind of build and build and build, this is really an awesome game. I've been kind of, you know, seeing it on its way for probably a little over a year now, and I know that some folks have been beating their heads against it for a few years, but yeah. It is getting ready to come out, which is awesome.
And we have some new stuff we announced at Midwinter, right?
Yeah. We're doing Scion Dragon and Mask of the Mythos, so we're going to have a Cthulhu-inspired pantheon, so you can kind of see what that would look like. What? Really? That's the sound you chose?
Well, it was that, or it was, unfortunately...
Why? Why do you hate me?
Oh, it doesn't stop.
Oh, God, stop it! Stop.
It does if you swipe it off.
No, what have you done?
Well, there we go. We have now pitched 10 different games. We have sold people on 10 different games that are either upcoming or out.
Have we? Have we really?
We have attempted
to sell people on 10 different games.
Well, I feel like the Hadouken at the end was our silent, deferential nod to the Street Fighter RPG. We didn't need to give it 5 minutes. You know, we could just give it those 5 seconds. That was enough.
I have so many opinions about the Street Fighter RPG, but that's not the reason why we've come through today.
No.
But with all that being done, thank you guys for indulging in my drive time format, if you will. If people wanted to talk to either of you about these games, where would they find you online? Dixie, I'll start with you.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and the forums and most places as Dixie Cyanide. I hang out a lot. It's fun.
Matthew?
I've expended all my energy. You can also find me sitting in my apartment in Delaware because I'm done. I'm done for the day now.
Yeah. I've come down from a high. It's like we've just got off a very long roller coaster.
Right. It's like, I'm spent.
You can find me if you like, I guess. I'm on... I'm in various venues as a gentleman gamer. I am on Twitter as ClackClickBang. I'm on the Onyx Path YouTube channel, which you should really subscribe to and click that bell so you get notified whenever there's a new upload. I will say that a week and a half ago, as of time of uploading, you will find a character creation video for Exalted. If you are interested in Exalted, I think that will be in the last couple of days of the Lunar's Kickstarter. So do check it out if you are at all on the fence. It will give you a good idea of what Lunar's is about.
I think the Kickstarter is actually over at this point. But
what?
Yeah.
Time dilation!
Well, check it out on BackerKit in 2 weeks' time.
Right.
Yeah, do that.
You will get your Lunar's somehow. And people can find me on Twitter as Eddie Fate, on Facebook as Eddie Web Writer. You can find my professional stuff at most social media sites at Pugsteady. Also, you can go to pugsteady.com. And just recently, if you're interested in some of our kind of adjacent references, the first episode I worked on with Extra Credits about tabletop role-playing games went up, and I got to talk about Cavaliers of Mars, and there's a little reference to Pugmire in there as well. So if you want to see animated people and an animated version of me chastising people for about 10 minutes talking about tabletop role-playing games, go check that out.
Yeah, I want to add to you that if this is one of your first episodes and you haven't listened to all the interview episodes, but you want more information on like Promethean, go find our Steffi Devan episode.
Oh, yes.
If you want more information on Cavaliers, go find the Rose Bailey episode. Information on Scion, go find the Neil Price episode. Like, we have so many different like deep dives that we've done. More Exalted, we talked to Eric Minton. So we have, you know, dived into a couple of these before. So if you're, you know, just coming into this, maybe go check out the backlog if you want some more information.
Absolutely. And with that, Many worlds, one path.
Eddie, Matthew, and Dixie in the morning.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, driving your cars out on a sunny morning, we want all of you to scream at your loudest on the early morning road show with Dixie, Eddie, and Matthew.